31st of August. How could it be? Are you a summer chaser? I am, by all means, in every possible definition, a summer chaser. How could it be? I just don't understand how summer just whoosh, flies on by. 11 o'clock in New York City. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Always appreciate you guys listening, spreading the word about what we do. All the different hosts here are very, very proud to be on the Gary Noel Network. And what's your Labor Day about? Yeah, still making plans for myself. Again, still hard to believe. Man. But you know what? There's some great things going on in the city here, certainly around the world. Sending some very, very positive thoughts to Houston. It's still unfathomable when I see these images and read about the devastation. And we don't even know, really know. I mean, they're trying to put dollar signs to this. How can you when the city is still under feet of water? Hopefully this water, this rain, subsides in the next 24 hours, but unlikely. But the rain is going to mostly cease quickly. But our thoughts, nothing but positive thoughts for Houston. So we're going to meet an incredible woman today. Two-time ringside world champion boxer, national Golden Glove champion. And if that's not enough, she's broken the glass ceiling in the world of business. That's right. Not only is she a top dog in the ring, in the corporate confines, she's broken the glass ceiling. And I'm not even talking about in the last 5 years. I'm talking about when it was even more unique and more challenging. A woman of color, a woman who is a woman in corporate America to do that 15 years ago is even another accolade that she should wear proudly, because Jackie Atkins is a phenomenal person. We're going to hear her story of adversity and all the successes she's had in her life and all the great things she's doing to benefit children, young adults, youth, so they too can have a great and golden opportunity in life like we all should, right? So we all have been reading about autonomous vehicles and cars that drive themselves. Well, check this out. In Michigan, there's a prototype. And I'm interested in this for two reasons. Number one, because I love pizza. What is an auto selfless driving car having to do with pizza? Well, there's a prototype out there that's going to be delivering Domino's pizza. That's right. So you order the pizza online. The car shows up with your pizza in there, but the window won't go down until you plug in your boop, 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 last four digits of your phone number. So this is something that they're really hoping it's going to take off, because obviously they're going to be making driverless cars for the obvious, for people to text why they don't drive, because that's kind of what they do now, right? But now it'll be legal. But now they want to do it in more of a service-based industry. So I imagine when Amazon has all the drones it could possibly buy in the world, and the air is just cluttered with their drones, they can have their Amazon driverless cars delivering whatever that you just bought a couple hours ago. So it's pretty interesting that something of this caliber is here. Months away in 2017, you should see this car. It's really well equipped. There's all these satellites, all these different ways to monitor lane changing, sensors, lights, curbs, cars, people. Obviously, there's a lot of variables I started thinking about, even talking to my son, like, well, what would happen if X happened, or Y, or Z? But it's kind of interesting, though, when I saw it on the news the other day and read up about it, about the fact that Domino's, and they probably paid big bucks. I'm sure there was a lot of chains and corporations that were vying, jockeying for this position, because not only is obviously the autonomous car getting a great deal of attention, but the actual retailer attached to this. So it's a great deal. And in New York City, you know, we've always been on the cutting edge. Not on the cutting edge of autonomous cars, but that's okay, because it's probably not the ideal city for that. But Giuliani, I'm Bloomberg. Giuliani was certainly responsible for the whole recreation, reverberation. Now, how about the, my God, I've been up too early today. 42nd Street, revitalization of 42nd Street has just been incredible. I remember reading years ago how the mayor, Giuliani, said, we're going to try to get Disney. And Disney was like, okay. And everyone's like, what, Disney? You're committing to 42nd Street where there's just obviously sex for sale, drugs, you name it. Debaucherous row of eight blocks and X amount of blocks deep. And you build it, that type of thing would happen. They came. And that's the kind of the end of the story there. Now, Bloomberg, I mean, he had a lot of vision as well. And one of his visions was to obviously decrease smoking in public spaces in New York City. And he did an incredible job. The first city in the country to do that. And many cities. Actually, I think there's only a handful of states, less than a handful, that are not on the same healthy trail as New York and the rest of the country. But I want to just point out something else that the Mayor de Blasio, I'm not a huge fan. He's okay. I don't know how anyone can not beat him. But then again, the caliber of talent running for mayor is pretty slim. It's bad. It's not that good. Anyway, so I digress. So he has just actually signed a very, very sweeping legislation the other day. And it's so important, I think, to mention this because they want to reduce smoking down to 12% here in New York City by 2020. And that's an admirable and lofty goal, I think. Right now, actually, in 2002, it was at 21.5, down to 21.5%. In 2014, it was down to 14.3%. So currently, there. Take a guess, in your mind, how many people in Manhattan smoke? 900,000. That's a lot. So basically, almost a million people in an island of... Let me see. During the workday, I think there's about 14 or 15 million here. And then after the workday hour, I think it goes down to 7 or 8 million, something of that nature. So they're doing this on a few different ways, a few different platforms. They're going to increase the price of cigarettes to over $13 a pack. Now, we think that's a good thing, that if you don't have the money, you're not going to pay for it. But I've read that, and I've seen and I've spoken to people that regardless how expensive cigarettes are, people find a way to do it. And guess what? They will even sacrifice on food. Food, you say, right? I mean, tobacco is not edible, but it's an addiction. It's a drug. So the thing that really bothers me in the urban areas in New York City, people do sacrifice food for their family, for themselves, for cigarettes. So that in itself won't cure the problem and won't bring it down to the goal of 12% of New Yorkers. What they're doing in addition to that is that they're going to make it more expensive to be a retailer of cigarettes, which I think is a good idea because obviously it's going to be less lucrative for people, retail stores, to sell cigarettes, price of a pack, et cetera, and to be able to have that, you know, license to do it. And then this is kind of interesting. I really appreciate this, and this should have been done years ago. Actually, never should have happened, that pharmacies will not be able to sell cigarettes. No-brainer, right? Because you think if you're going into a facility that's all about health and wellness, oh, yeah, and I'll take a pack of condoms and some antibiotic medicine and a carton of cigarettes, please. So it just doesn't really go together. Maybe one of the other things doesn't go together as well, but, you know, hey, you never know. You got to live, right? So also the fact that the sales tax is going to go up as well in part of that. And that's part of the sales tax will be going into programs for education and to get people to marketing wise to stop smoking or reduce smoking, et cetera. So it's a great initiative. You know, de Blasio and his city council came up with this, and I think it's a phenomenal goal. It's a lofty goal, but I mean, I think with the headway that Bloomberg has made and the country, and the way we're just living differently, Americans are living differently. I was at a show this past weekend down the Jersey Shore, which our guests will certainly understand where it was, Asbury Park, Stone Pony, one of the greatest rock and roll venues in New Jersey. And I'd probably say one of the top, probably one's a smaller club in the country because a lot of A rock and roll celebrities have gone through there one time or another, either coming up or part of a tour, but it's a great venue. Anyway, I'm outside the other day checking out Gary Clark, and a few other really good bands. And there was a few people smoking next to me. I was like, whoa, this is so random. This is so weird. I'm so unconditioned to this because it was kind of a millennial crowd to 40s-ish. And it was just so kind of foreign. My wife and I looking at each other like, wow. And yes, I know people still do smoke, but it was just kind of weird when you find yourself in a situation like that where people are smoking and it kind of, you know, baffles the mind, certainly. But... you know, it's, I understand it's an addiction, and I had my fair share of dealing with vices in my life, to put it lightly, as we've as you've heard me speak here before on the show about drugs and alcohol and cocaine, etc. But that, it's a great initiative, and I appreciate that certainly, and I hope it's a great success for everyone here in New York City, and hopefully it's a precedent that's set countrywide. So did you watch the VMAs the other day? No. Well, why not? Because they typically are not good? Yes, I understand that. So I did have an opportunity to throw it on, and I was displeased for 80% of it. But there were two portions of it that made me very, very happy. No, it's not the section where Lorde got up on stage. You know Lorde, she was a big hit, came out like 2-3 years ago. She has a new single out, new album out right now. But she didn't sing. Oh, you're thinking she lip-synced. No, she didn't do that either. She just danced to her own song. It was like me dancing on a stage or in my living room, or like you dancing in your living room. Like, I didn't get it. But what I did get was the fact that they did a great dedication. They actually had an award, Vanguard Award. It's the statue, the spaceman for VMA MTV that's been started since, what, 1980 or so? 81. And the Vanguard Award went to Pink. And Pink got up on stage, and she had some incredibly positive, encouraging words about people that are different. And here's Pink.
Thank you. If I may, I just broke it. I just broke it. I know I don't have a lot of time, but if I may tell you a quick story. Recently I was driving my daughter to school, and she said to me, out of the blue, Mama. I said, yes, baby. She said, I'm the ugliest girl I know. And I said, huh? And she was like, yeah, I look like a boy with long hair. And my brain went to, oh my God, you're six, why? Where is this coming from? Who said this? Can I kick a six-year-old's ass? Like, what? But I didn't say anything, and instead I went home, and I made a PowerPoint presentation for her. And in that presentation were androgynous rock stars and artists that live their truth, are probably made fun of every day of their life, and carry on and wave their flag and inspire the rest of us. And these are artists like Michael Jackson and David Bowie and Freddie Mercury and Annie Lennox and Prince and Janis Joplin and George Michael, Elton John. So many artists. Her eyes glazed over. But then I said, you know, I really want to know why you feel this way about yourself. And she said, well, I look like a boy. And I said, well, what do you think I look like? And she said, well, you're beautiful. And I was like, well, thanks. But I said, when people make fun of me, that's what they use. They say that I look like a boy, or I'm too masculine, or I have too many opinions. My body is too strong. And I said to her, I said, do you see me growing my hair? She said, no, Mama. I said, do you see me changing my body? No, Mama. Do you see me changing the way I present myself to the world? No, Mama. Do you see me selling out arenas all over the world? Yes, Mama. Okay, so, baby girl, we don't change. We take the gravel in the shell and we make a pearl. And we help other people to change so that they can see more kinds of beauty. And to all the artists here, I'm so inspired by all of you. Thank you for being your true selves and for lighting the way for us. I'm so inspired by you guys. There's so much rad happening right now in music. And keep doing it. Keep shining for the rest of us to see. And you, my darling girl, are beautiful. And I love you. Thank you, MTV.
That's poignant. I love what Pink had to say. My mantra is when I speak to audiences, whether they're 5 years old, 15, 25, 55, my difference makes me stronger. We all have a difference that we struggle with at some point in life, and maybe we're still struggling with it, but it really makes us unique. And some of the differences that we wish away or wish we could change, but then sometimes you got to take a step back and realize they are a part of your DNA. They make you who you are. And maybe when you're younger, it's hard to accept the way you look, or maybe the way you sound, or maybe the way you're accepted. But that's okay, because you just have to work harder on being confident and understanding you are you for a reason. Like Pink said, I mean, she's androgynous. She has androgynous friends, androgynous rock stars, and people look different and people sound different. And that's okay. It's not about changing who you are. It's about changing the perception about what is normal, what is good, what should be accepted, what's popular, what's in vogue, etc. So I really embrace what Pink had to say, and I really appreciate her taking that time. Obviously, the Vanguard Award is given to somebody who's insightful, who's able to see past divisions and to have a greater perspective on life and beyond music. Obviously, music and life are representative of each other. Obviously, we know that music is reflective of pain, love, fear, elation, you name it. And that's just a great summation of MTV's VMA Awards. If you didn't watch any other part of the show, except for the next part that I'm going to talk about, then you're okay. But it was nice to see that, along with a great song that Logic did. It's part of a suicide prevention song, a message of love, unity, certainly in a state of divisiveness. Our country is in a state of divisiveness, as you know. And DJ Logic, I always say DJ Logic, singer, rapper Logic, sang a song. It's called 1-800-273-8255. Now, what's the name of that song mean? It's the National Suicide Prevention Line. And the song didn't do much for me, and that's okay. It doesn't have to win a Grammy or a VMA award, but the fact is that he is putting it out there. It was introduced by Kesha, and what's her name? Joined him on stage. I saw her on, she opened for Coldplay. She's young. Kassira. It'll come to me. Anyway, she's really good. She's phenomenal. She's young. She's into the movement of mental health and mental illness, putting it out there, understanding that just like any other part of your body, you know, we get injured. Brain chemistry differs. Events happen in your life that impact you, and how we can, it's not the end. It doesn't mean that you're losing your mind or that people will think differently of you. But if they do think differently of you, shame on them, not shame on you. You're going to be smart enough, ask for help, talk to people, and realize that this is just part of life. This is part of your anatomy. This is who you are. And it could be a fleeting thing, could be something that you have to battle maybe periodically through your life. Maybe it's something that will happen maybe one more time in your life. But if not, it's imperative to know the warning signs. Know that there's help out there. Medically, people that love you, to do the right thing and for yourself and just to reach out. So it was really interesting to see this song performed by Logic, his song 1-800-273-8255. And more importantly, it was punctuated by people who came out on the stage wearing T-shirts that say 1-800-273-8255. And these were survivors of suicide. Now, if you have been in this circle of the world of suicide, there are kind of two understandings of survivors of suicide. Survivors of suicide are people who are survivors or attempters that failed and or changed their mind the last second or just happened to live. Another term of survivors of suicide are people who are left behind from people who took their lives. So it kind of gets confusing. I'm not sure why they don't make it a little bit more of a different vernacular in terms of survivors of suicide, because you always have to kind of clarify it when you're not in people in the, I hate to say industry, or in the know, or in the setting of mental health professionals, et cetera. So I thought that sent a really, really good message with Pink's statement about being different and embracing your difference. And then we have the suicide prevention message of, you know, that you will survive, you can make it, with a number, with people coming out on stage showing just how strong one can be collectively and how one can just get help, and also that suicide is not the answer. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. We're getting on a brighter note right here. 20 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock in New York City. Labor Day weekend. What's your plans? Going to be beautiful weather around here. Hoping that things are going to be shaping up, certainly for Houston. And I want to introduce my guest today, Jackie Atkins. Jackie is just an amazing woman on many, many levels, because not only is she from New Jersey, she's a woman of color who's pushed the color barriers and the ceiling aside because she listened to her heart. It's my pleasure to introduce Jackie Atkins. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
What's that?
It's good to be here.
One-arm push-ups. How many can you do?
At least 20.
At least 20? Oh, my God. I'm completely embarrassed and mortified. Wow, two-time ringside world champion, national Golden Glove champion, and you have another award or accolade to announce that you received earlier this week. Come closer to the mic, please.
Okay. Yes, so I just received a letter that in December I'm being inducted into the New Jersey Martial Arts Hall of Fame for boxing.
So, how does that make you feel?
Thank you. It makes me feel proud.
Yeah, recognized.
Really great. Really great.
Yeah. Now, what makes you more proud? Something of that caliber, getting the recognition, or the fact that you, at a very young age, obviously you went to college, you got a degree in computer science, and back in early 80s, that was kind of like cutting edge, right? Because,
yes,
you know, computers were, you know, still filled big rooms back then, and mainframes, and that was the deal. And then you got a job out of college as a maintenance worker at a facility. And the facility was Bell Labs, right? AT&T Bell Labs. Was that in Homedale, New Jersey?
That was in Homedale.
Homedale, yes. New Jersey. And you weren't designing software. You weren't on the help desk then, because the help desk actually, I don't think, existed back then. Right. But more importantly, you were cleaning the facility and at the dream job or facility that you worked towards. And was that a hard decision for you to make? Because thinking, I have a college degree, but I'm going to be pushing a cart around, emptying trash bins, but this is one step closer to where I want to be.
It was a conscious decision. I had a full-time position in the city, actually, and I chose the maintenance position in the evenings at AT&T Bell Labs. I had my heart set on working in the labs, number one in technology. I mean, they only hired the cream of the crop. And although I had a very good-paying job in New York, that it was my desire to work there. And I was determined. I set my vision on AT&T Bell Labs, so I used that maintenance position, being in that environment, to gain access to the knowledge, to everything that was within that particular building.
What was your day job in New York City?
I was in finance. I was actually designing GUI user interface in the finance industry for Morgan Stanley at that time.
So that's fascinating. So it wasn't like you were just trying to make ends meet. You're still in your line of work. Maybe not the ultimately desired position that you wanted. Okay. But still, after all that time, you would get it back on a bus or a train, go to New Jersey, and moonlight as a maintenance worker. Now, were you worried about being perceived as somebody who's a maintenance worker? Or did they know, management know, or your supervisor know that what you actually achieved, your education and what you were doing during the day?
That never really mattered to me, Mark. I mean, you know, I've been a person where if I set my mind on something, I'm really not concerned with perception. You know, most of my life, I've taken the road least traveled, especially by a woman of color. So I was not concerned with the perception at all.
So how did the transformation happen, the progression from being a maintenance worker to reading the job openings, availabilities? postings.
Yeah, so we'd empty carts at night. And, of course, whatever went in the garbage was garbage. And I would just read. I'd take advantage of any literature. And at that time, the labs had their own proprietary language. And I decided, okay, I'm going to learn this. So I did. I learned the programming language. I studied for, I want to say, about 6 to 7 months. And a temp position opened up within AT&T Bell Labs. So I stepped out on faith. I resigned from my full-time position in the city. And I took the temp position at AT&T Bell Laboratories.
Okay, Jackie, you got to put the brakes on now.
Okay.
So here you are studying all this proprietary information, soaking it in like a sponge. Osmosis taking place as well, because I don't know when you slept. Maybe you put it under your head when you're taking a train into New York City. So talk to me about applying for this job. They saw, obviously, on your resume what your degree is in, computer science, but they're asking you, okay, well, you're here cleaning at night. You must really, really want and desire a position here, because obviously you're giving 1,000% just to even get in this office for a temp position.
Yes.
So they saw your desire and love for, you know, to contribute to the success of Bell Labs.
Correct. And my hiring supervisor at that time, I can remember him saying to me, wow, he says, you really want this position?
Mm.
And I said, absolutely.
You probably said to him, I want your position.
I didn't say that, but he said at the end of the interview, he said, I see myself working for you. 10
wow.
years down the road.
That's admirable. Yeah, that's admirable that somebody could say that. Was that a male or female?
A male.
It was.
Right.
Back then, what year is this now?
This was 85? In the mid-80s, yeah.
85. 85, to be sitting across a desk from an African-American woman who was cleaning the offices at night, but obviously well-respected because you had the job, the GUI job? I never heard of GUI. I had to Google
user
that after.
Interface.
Oh, okay. That's phenomenal. And to know how many women were actually at Bell Labs at that time, and not even in a managerial position, just in the software or designing positions?
I don't remember
many.
Yeah,
minimal.
Yeah, I'd say not even a handful.
Wow.
You know, most of the women in position at the labs at that time were either in the mail room or the typing pools. At that time, they still had what they called a typing pool.
Mm, sure.
You know, and then some administrative positions.
Now we're going to put the brakes on again, because you actually made a cognizant decision years before, because you're a great athlete. Track star, you were offered a full scholarship. Where's the scholarship to?
Maryland, College Park.
Fantastic.
Right.
And you declined it.
I declined it.
You declined it because you didn't think you could get a 4.0 and be a star athlete, because you'd probably be too concerned about your scholarship.
Correct.
You made the right decision, yeah. I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Was it a tough decision back then? I mean, that's an astute and kind of a conundrum to be in at such a young age.
Right. And at that time, I didn't realize how tough of a decision that was. It was much later in life than I realized, like, wow, you know, I made this choice. And it was a good choice. It was a right choice, clearly.
And how your life's trajectory could have been completely changed.
Exactly.
Not that you couldn't have gone and had a successful career as a track star. And who knows, maybe have been an Olympian and then gone to, back into the software world. But, you know, chances are probably it would have been diminished in terms of your odds.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your support system, your parents, and the mantras and the roles they modeled for you as a kid. And is that kind of the cloth that you were cut from?
Yes. I have two great parents, my mom and dad. They've been married over 60 years,
wow.
60 plus years. They're still
Can they
here,
do one-arm push-ups too?
My dad probably can. At 85, my dad probably
God
could.
Bless him. Papa
yeah.
Atkins.
Yeah. But my parents, they were unique in many ways. You know, they were adventurous. They introduced us to things that most families, African-American families, weren't exposed to. My parents made it a point. They sacrificed every year to take us on vacations, and not the average vacation. I mean, we traveled the world as children, and you know, Mark, at that
time.
So
eye-opening.
Yes, huge. And at that time, I didn't understand the value and the sacrifice that they were making. It was much later that I realized, wow, you know, those trips, the sacrifices they made financially to take five children, there are five of us,
wow,
on vacations,
yeah,
you know.
But what they were doing in feeding your mind and expanding your horizons,
exactly,
you just don't realize that. I mean, my son's the executive producer, quote, quote, is in the other room. But my wife is right now touring New York City with my five-year-old, because this is something that you just, it's a rite of passage, especially when you're this close to the city. And then to be able to take them out and travel worldwide to see other cultures, customs is invaluable, especially in this era that we're living in.
Correct. You learn respect for other cultures. There's, it also instilled a desire for me, you know, to want to travel. I always felt as though I could do anything. With my parents, we were raised in a household where you weren't defined by your sex. You know, the same way my brother took out the garbage, I took out the garbage. You know, my parents worked as a team to raise five wonderful children. And I look at today as far as where I am. I mean, I'm in a place where you don't see many women. You know, I'm the president of USA Boxing. I'm the first woman ever to be president of New Jersey Boxing. Again,
a big testament.
I don't believe I'd be here,
yeah,
correct,
yeah,
if it had not been for my mom and dad.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, they obviously set the bar pretty high for you, not with the expectations of you exceeding in terms of, I can't put words in your mouth, maybe putting a lot of pressure on you, but just giving you all the advantages that you would need in life to get the education that you need, the drive and the initiative and the belief in yourself.
Right.
I mean, those things, you know, you can bring a horse to water.
Right, true.
And the rest is on you. So here you are, back at Bell Labs. How long did it take you to become executive director of R&D, research and development?
Oh, I was a technical manager for probably about 8 years. And then promoted to associate director and then executive director. So probably took me a little more than 15 years.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how many other women were at that level in different departments throughout the company of Bell Labs?
At that time, my peers, I believe there was one other woman when I was first promoted to executive director. And she actually was a mentor for me.
Fantastic. How did you feel you were treated? Were you treated equally?
That's a tough one. No, not necessarily. But I overcame the obstacles, you know. I try not to focus too much on inequalities because, as we know, we're living in a world where things are not equal.
No.
You know? But
back then it was such a much more prevalent, I should say.
Right.
Is it something that bothered you to the point where you contemplated leaving, or you felt that you would just be able to keep, you know, paving the road ahead and working hard, and your work and testament to the job would be enough of a message?
It fueled me.
Mm.
It actually fueled me.
Good.
Yes. You know, I used it to overcome many challenges. I'm very driven, but when you add something like that to the mix, then it just gave me more drive.
Sure. So now you have two factors, a woman and then an African-American woman. So that's, you know, could be something that's very, very difficult to overcome in a workplace back in 85, 86, 87. But it's great to see, obviously, that you were rewarded with titles. I'm not sure if your salary was commensurate with other executive directors at the time. But that's something, obviously, that people who rise and are the trailblazers of your era or in any era in any specific industry or career that have to deal with. It's not easy to break a glass ceiling. But when you're in that role, whether it was a good time or a bad time, did you ever take a step back and say, wow, I'm doing something that's much bigger than me?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. The time I was at AT&T Bell Labs, I also volunteered in the evenings working with youth in a boxing facility. And everything
that's with the Police Athletic League?
Yes, in Long Branch. And all of the things that I learned, you know, all of the obstacles, let's call them, that I dealt with, I used that to teach these children. I was a true believer that your circumstances do not define you. your socioeconomic status does not define you. And I was able to teach my children and share my experiences with the youth to help them to become better citizens and to become successful and to have vision.
And you also did that at West Point before they had a boxing program. How did you introduce boxing to West Point for women?
At the time, the women were not allowed to compete in the sport of boxing. Boxing for women was a hobby club in West Point. The male team, very well-established male team, consisted of probably about 60, 70 male athletes. And then you had 12 to 14 women that were training, but again, they weren't allowed to compete in the collegiate ranks. I ran into one of the members of the hobby club, and she asked me if I would come take on that battle to fight for the women to have a right to compete at West Point. So in doing that, in taking that on, I ended up stepping into the role of head coach for the women's boxing team.
Which, by the way, is about 3 hours away from where you were residing at the time.
Round trip.
Upstate New York.
Yes.
I mean, that was quite an undertaking. So you're working a major position as an executive director, and you're going up to, I forget this the town that it's in. What's it called? Do you remember the town?
West Point.
Yeah. I forget the town. Anyway, so it's I used to go up there for the games all the time. Army, Navy, every year. I used to love it. So this is another way, another mold you're breaking. Did you realize that at the time? And how much significance did that play in your role?
I did realize it. You know, when the young lady came to me and she said, we're not allowed to compete. Again, there's always something that drives you, and I've always used, you know, those challenges as fuel. So, you know, I saw myself taking it on, but I also knew it wasn't a long-term commitment. I figured, you know what, let me get them started. Let me get these women in there, and let's prove that they're worthy of competing.
And let me assist them in getting two championships?
Two collegiate national championships,
wow.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
5 gold, 4 silver. I love to say that. But yes, you know, and I mean, the women, they were driven. You know, they're cadets. They're in a military academy. They were driven, and they had vision, and I just came along to assist them in achieving that.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. My very profound guest is Jackie Atkins. Jackie is an entrepreneur, a very successful business leader, and a two-time champion, ringside world champion, I should say, national Golden Glove champion, and just a heck of a nice person. Now, all this was attributed to you playing in your aunt's front yard?
Oh, my grandmother.
Grandmother's front yard in Red Bank, New Jersey, with nunchucks. And take it away from there.
Correct. So I was, all my parents actually enrolled all 5 of us in a martial arts program in Red Bank. And I was very good with weapons. And I was actually outside.
And your arms are weapons. Let it be known, if you're watching via Facebook, you can see.
So I was outside playing with my nunchucks, and one of the local officers stopped through, and he took me around the corner to the Red Bank Police Athletic League boxing gym, and he introduced me to boxing, and I just fell in love with it. And from that day on, I'd go around the corner every day, and I'd train in the boxing gym.
See, it's very interesting, because when I hear about your story more and more, I'm just amazed by all the precedents that were set. Okay, back in that era, what was it, 1978?
Yes,
I'm guessing,
70s.
You tell me. 70.
Yes,
okay, 70. A police officer in Red Bank, which was did not go far from gentrified back then. What was the race back then? Maybe a third black? Red Bank?
Red Bank, probably about a third.
Okay. Was the officer African-American?
Yes, he was.
Okay. To take the time, which is great. I mean, this is so admirable to see the fact that a child is interested in something and taking it a step further is just mind-blowing. I just love to hear things of that nature. I mean, that set, you know, the momentum and kind of a path for you. that was, we talk about the behavior and discipline that you've been able to incorporate, and it all comes from obviously your parents as role models and sport. And that mere act of him taking you to the local PAL, and that mantra that you devised for yourself, that how you can be resilient in the corporate world, maybe not being paid the same as your equals because you're a woman of color, for whatever reason, and then being able to go to West Point and bring in a program and have multiple awards and accolades and titles, and then starting, how many years ago is this? I believe 7 years ago, a nonprofit organization that started here at the Jackie Gleason Gym. Jackie Gleason?
It's Gleason's
Gym. Gleason's
Gym.
Jackie Gleason is, yes. That's the actor who passed away a long time ago. And that name of the organization is Give a Kid a Dream?
Give a Kid a Dream.
That it's kind of unstoppable. There's nothing that really slows you down. Trying to get you on a phone is very impossible. My producer was like, I don't know if we can get her in a studio here. She's just too impossible. She's too busy. But understandable, because it just proves once again how in your formidable years and how to have a positive force in any life, whether it's one person or a multitude of person, like it takes a village, that how pivotal it is for the outcome for someone to be driven, successful. And success doesn't have to be monetary. I mean, you talked about making $40,000 a year to up to $200,000 a year. And was there any difference in your happiness back then?
No. Actually, today I'm much happier, and I'm no longer at AT&T Bell Labs, so I no longer receive the huge paycheck. But
I'm sure you were wise with your money.
Yes, but I have to say I'm much happier now. You know, the mentors that molded and shaped me in my life, I'm trying to give back in the same manner that they gave to me. So, yes, I'd have to say my happiness has gone to a totally different level.
So now you're on the Jersey Shore with your program, Give a Kid a Dream. And what do you instill in kids? And when they see you, they must be like in awe. Their jaws must drop. I mean, here's a woman with, I don't know what's bigger, her beaming smile or her arms.
my kids, they're great. I have different ages, from the ages of 8 on up. They come in at first, you know, especially some of the young men. They're a little taken back by a woman teaching them boxing. But I also have a huge support system. I have 7 coaches, and they're all men, that volunteer their time to the program. They're great individuals, very given, and they too act as mentors to the youth. So you say it takes a village. There is a village here at Gleason's Jersey Shore, and this whole village embraces these young children.
Do you find it's a more of a target or a special duty for you to, when you get a girl, a young woman, to kind of take her under your wing even more so because of your experience and where you came from and where you were able to go?
Yes, I do. I see some of the young ladies that come in, and again, these are girls between the ages of, say, 10 and 15, and, you know, they don't always have self-esteem. You know, some of the kids have dealt with adversity, mm-hmm. and just equipping them to overcome and to help them understand their worth and the fact that, you know, all things are possible and they're capable of great things. With the young ladies, I relate a little bit more. You know, because I was that girl.
Sure.
So, yes.
And do you believe that mentoring is possible outside of the ring? With your expertise, obviously, is in and out of the ring. So do you have a preference, whether it's with gloves on or gloves off?
No, I don't. Actually, I mentor more outside of the ring than I do inside of the ring.
In what capacity? In the same forum?
Same forum. Boxing for New Jersey Give a Kid a Dream, it's a hook. You know, it's a way to get the kids in. Less than 5% of the youth that come through our doors are going to ever compete in boxing.
And that's okay.
It is. It's
sure.
Okay. As far as them becoming champions, and I call the program Champions of Life because that's really what it's about. You know, it's not just about getting in the ring and winning a trophy or a medal. Many of them will never compete, but they will compete in life. So teaching them, in life, when you're knocked down, you get back up. You know, teaching them to bob and weave adversity and, you know, all the things that life's going to throw at them, using boxing as that metaphor to help them overcome and to achieve greatness. That's really the goal.
And I think that puts it in realistic terms, because I don't like, I'm not one of these speakers when I speak to youth and young adults about you can be that professional boxer, that NFL star, the NBA champion, because the chances are, and I'm really surmising this, that you're telling people to buy a lottery ticket, to play lottery. Because, but you got to have a plan B. You can keep buying that lottery ticket and keep practicing basketball, football, hockey, whatever the case may be, whatever sport or discipline. But just know that the odds are not in your favor. And that's okay. And I don't mean to be a black cub, but I'm just a realist. I want people to understand that they have to have a solid foundation. You know, that belief system, that education, that invaluable education. So if they, even if they do get drafted and they're, you know, they break their tibia and they're out for the year, or they're done in football, or they had too many concussions by being in a boxing ring or on the football field, the gridiron, that there are options, and you have to prepare yourself. Whether you're a woman, a man, orange, black, yellow, doesn't matter. But we have to have options, and it's just not fair. I think when I lose a speaking gig to a football player, and I say to the person, and I say, it's great, because I'm sure he has a great tale. But what are the odds of anyone in that room becoming an NFL player? Slim to none. And if they are, what's the average lifespan of an NFL player in terms of playing years? 3 years, average years. So what are you telling these kids? It's not realistic. I think it's more realistic to talk about the person who overcame a lot of obstacles and was resilient and got a job in the field that they love, or temporary worked in somewhere, UPS, while they earned enough money to go to college at nights to get the degree they needed to work at a Bell Labs or a Vonage nowadays, or Amazon and design software, or create a progressive radio network, or whatever the case may be, because I think that is much more attainable and realistic.
Yes, I agree.
So I think we have to be careful with messages to kids. And it's important. You can be anything you want, but you have to understand their realistic expectations.
Correct. And one of the things that we discuss every session I have with my kids, I end it with something educational, you know?
For example?
Okay, the other
A squared plus B squared?
No, A squared plus B squared.
Good.
Some of the students are somewhat timid. So, you know, the other day I'm saying, okay, how do I get them to bring out, to be assertive? So I asked them, does everyone know what assertive means? And I was surprised, even some of my teens, they said no. So I challenged them. I said, okay, tomorrow when you guys come into the gym, I want you to define assertive as well as timid. And so they came in yesterday, actually, and I said, okay, who did their homework? And, you know, one of my, she's 10 years old, she says, coach, timid means unsure. I said, so when you were executing your jab and your cross, your 1-2 yesterday, what did unsure look like? Show me the timid execution. And she got it. She understood. It was not putting forth all your energy and your effort and just kind of holding back and really, you know, not digging in. So I said, okay, so what is assertive? What is the other word I gave you? No one looked it up. So they had to run stairs for about 2 or 3 minutes. So I told them,
okay. So you asserted your power.
Oh, I asserted. So I said, guys, when you come back in next week, I expect you to know the definition of assertive and to be able to exhibit that. I said, because a few of you, when you were executing the combination, you were very timid. You weren't sure of yourself. And if there's nothing I teach you, you know, I teach you to be sure. I teach you that you're great. We have a chant that we do at the end of the workout. And they define themselves. They've defined what a champion is. And again, this has nothing to do with boxing. It has to do with champions of life. Mm. Champions are great. Champions are strong. They're intelligent. And I said, guys, you're saying this, so you need to live it. It needs to become who you are. And so I said, next week you come back and we're going to define that word, assertive. And we're going to live by that definition. And so they all left on that note. So our program is much more than boxing. As a matter of fact, there's not as much boxing as you would expect in a boxing program.
Well, that's great. I mean, you're talking about a 10-year-old. So, I mean, this is all about molding and giving these children at critical points in their life options and opening their eyes to what's out there. And also probably giving them some form of escape, because I'm sure some of them come from troubled homes. Have had some adversity, maybe broken homes, single parents, maybe they live with their grandparents or foster kids, whatever the case may be. And to come here and have an outlet and to have somebody as worldly as yourself, as a mentor, as a leader, to present all these different possibilities. Yes, ring is a way, the boxing gloves and sweating and laughing and joking around and jumping rope and doing double dutch, I'm sure it's a great icebreaker. But these messages that are being instilled, have you gotten very close, or have you seen any examples where somebody, a student, has come up to you, a mentee, and said, you know, a situation happened and they told you the story, and within that story you saw and understood and experienced what you have taught them?
Yes, I have so many examples of that. There's a young lady right now, she just graduated college, and when she came to me years ago, she was being bullied in school, very low self-esteem, just, you know, struggling. At one time, we actually were very concerned. You know, you hear a lot about kids committing suicide mm-hmm. because of this bullying. I mean, it's very ugly. And this young lady now comes back whenever I need her to speak to the students to tell them, hey, this is what I learned from Coach Jackie and the other coaches here in this program.
And what did she learn about bullying?
She learned, I used to always tell her, bring your bully to the gym. She learned how to deal with that. You know, she learned that she was better than the bully. And she learned how to overcome. You know, and she's done some great things. She had, you know, 4.0 when she came out of Monmouth University. And now she's getting married, starting her own family. But she's doing great things. You know, and she said, I never saw myself speaking to a group of young adults and sharing my story. She said, but now, you know, thanks to this program, you know, I can do that.
Looking back 15 years ago, 20 years ago, did you see yourself working, whether at Bell Labs or an equally successful, prominent company at the time, as an executive director or some status of that level, becoming a champion in your own right on two different levels, and possibly being named, you know, a Hall of Famer wherever it happens to be, New Jersey. Did you think of those titles and/or levels of achievement at that time?
No, I did not. No, I mean,
I don't think one often does.
Yeah, no.
Unless you're in a specific career, like I won a Grammy, I'm a musician. Like there's some defining mark, which I don't think really means anything. It's just a trophy on a mantle. But I think some people do. But especially, I think in your world, if it's a little bit more just about, you know, listening to the fire that's in your belly.
Right. Correct. Correct.
And what about your parents? How pleased are they to have seen all their fruition, all their work come to fruition, I should say?
I'd have to say my dad is the most proud, you know, and he jokes a lot. But when he speaks of me, I mean, I just see the happiness, the joy, like, wow, this is my daughter. And here's all she's accomplished.
Sure.
You know, and I always tell him, Dad, I attribute it to you and Mom.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So we only have a few minutes left, Jackie Atkins, but I want to talk to you quickly about your role. Still, certainly you're an entrepreneur. You're working on a business model right now. I'm not sure if we're actually allowed to publicly speak about this, but you can check out our website. Or are you on Twitter as well?
I am on Twitter. I'm actually converting from being Jackie Atkins to my brand. And yeah, we can speak about it. The trademark has been approved.
Okay, but your website for the kids is NJ. GAKAD.com. So it stands for New Jersey Give a Kid a Dream.com. NJGAKAD.com. But more importantly, before we get to your trademark, I want to talk to you about your role and how you broke the glass ceiling. I want you to address women and or anyone who feels like they have less of a chance in obtaining their goals in life because of who they are. What's your message for them?
That's a tough one. I'm going to use boxing as an analogy. One of the things that I've learned in life is there's always an opponent. There's always opposition. And it's up to you how you prepare yourself and how you deal with life's challenges with the opposition. So when I think of that other person on the other side of the ring, you know, that's my opponent, that's my opposition. No matter what life throws at you, and no matter how that opponent comes at me in the fight, I continue to move forward. I don't give up. I'm very driven. I continue, again, to move forward. And I don't allow any of the challenges to define me. I have a vision, and they say vision is equal to victory. As long as you have a vision, you can become victorious. I envision success, and I hear the music.
I love it. I love it. And furthermore, keep the gloves on.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Jackie Atkins, is a real pleasure. Hats off to you on many levels for being the person that you are and breaking the mold for many, many more people and millions to come. And more importantly, for the setting a nice open path, clear path for all the children's lives you touch.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Farrell. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com. Markfarrellmotivation.com. Have a grand Labor Day weekend. Reflect about what Labor Day is about. The people who made all these things possible for all of us here today. Gary Null is next. Special thanks to Kelsey, and of course, executive producer Luke. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great day.